I love the rain. When it's not raining, it feels like there's nothing between us, or there's just space and very separate. But there's something about the rain, it's like it just kind of holds you and reminds you that you're like totally part of nature. The line of nature just cuts right across. So if you have like seasonal affective disorder and this weather is totally bumming you out, I'm sorry for that little reflection. This is Paul Fulton, a mental health psychotherapist and meditation teacher, says, psychotherapy is a powerful tool for many issues, but it takes discernment to know what can and cannot be addressed in therapy. Analyzing problems innate to being born as a human may be akin to handing a shovel to someone caught in a pit, when what is really needed is a ladder. To recognize insecurity as a fact of human existence and not evidence of shameful shortcomings helps relieve ourselves of the unrealistic expectation that it is a problem we should be expected to solve, and allows for a different way of encountering, holding, and opening to this reality. This possibility is where our Dharma practice begins. Buddhism, the path of Dharma, it builds its philosophy from very basic existential observations. It doesn't sort of like start out there and then figure out who we are, what we should be. The building blocks are right there in the basics of human existence. And so Buddhism, at least how I've held it, is not so interested in speculating on, you know, grand metaphysical matters or building a kind of scientific model of the world or something. It's not determining whether we live in a geocentric or heliocentric world, or whether the Earth is flat or a sphere, you know. It starts with like very basic truths, observations. It's intense being human. Yeah. That doesn't take too much speculation, yeah? That's a fact of a different kind than the fact that there are 380,000 species of beetles, which is also a fact I learned today. And so we start real close in, you know, and these basic kind of observations of the intensity of being human, that we don't own our life, we don't control the tides of pleasure and pain and gain and loss, that our life is, as one teacher said, like a river with no banks. Now, it's said that that insight into the three characteristics, the theme of our retreat is freeing. Yeah. This is Stephen Batchelor. Letting go, even momentarily and unintentionally, of that desperate and obsessive grip on the self does not obliterate you, but opens you up to a fleeting and highly contingent world that you share with other anxious creatures like yourself. This can be frightening, for the only certainty in such a world is that at some point you will die. You realize that yourself is not a fixed thing or personal essence, but a tentative and confused story hastening towards its conclusion. This might prompt you to scurry back to the familiar perceptions, beliefs, and routines in which you feel secure. But once the process of emptying has started, to cling to such consolations will hinder you from feeling fully alive. To become empty is to encounter the raw, unfiltered contingency of life itself. The challenge of emptiness is to plunge into life's torrent rather than hover uncertainly on its brink. The opposite of contingency is necessity. No matter how ephemeral and insignificant I recognize this human life of mine to be, I cannot shake off an intuitive conviction that deep down my existence is necessary in the scheme of things. So it's a beautiful quote, kind of soaring rhetoric, yeah, and quite useful in lots of ways, but at other times, like, totally misattuned for what's needed in practice, yeah? Like, imagine if every time you came in for a practice discussion, Gil and I just, like, read that. Like, this might prompt you to scurry back to, you know, like, we just, and then bell rings, keep practice, right? It's like totally, you know, right at some moments and really wrong in others. And so, like, how do we actually prepare the heart to open to the existential condition? We usually, like, want to rush into the lurch and just open, you know? But as Gil was sharing, the capacity to actually open to the condition of the heart mind depends on some level of stability and well-being and confidence. Nietzsche said that that each person's entrusted with as much truth as they can tolerate, you know. And I hear lines like that, and I'm just like getting the kind of like macho mode of like, give it all to me, you know, right? And I was thinking about like, you know, sometimes if somebody comes up to you and says like, are you open to some feedback? You know, there's like such a compulsion to say yes, no matter how ready the heart is to open to that, you know, even if it's preceded by a whole defensive, you know, no, you know, we say, yes, I want it, I want it. But part of Dharma practice is actually like titrating the three characteristics, maybe. Getting bearable doses of our vulnerability. kids, as we know, are really best able to confront the difficulties, the contingencies, as Batchelor calls them, of life, if they've essentially lived in a cocoon, an illusion of safety and well-being, security. Yeah. My nephew, when he was three, he's four now, he had a kind of prolonged period where it seemed the only thing he cared about was predatory animals, like lions, tigers, that kind of thing. And you know, he's a three-year-old mind. It's like, I kind of think he sort of thought that there were mountain lions, like, just right outside Berkeley, you know, his Berkeley home, and just, like, you know, he's just living in a kind of world of threat. And so one time I was taking care of him, and we went over again and again how mountain lions, they can't get into your house, Gabriel, because they don't have hands, and so they can't open the doorknob. And if a mountain lion came to your Berkeley home, we would just yell at it, you know, and we, like, went loops and loops of just, like, reenacting, like, okay, till the point where it was like, okay, I can rest, yeah? And then at some point he said, oh yeah, lions, they get a lot of timeouts. Like, that was like his resolution to samsara, you know? So we can start to see in retreat especially that yeah, we're not three, of course, right? And but we nevertheless, like, many of the behaviors of body and mind can be construed as a kind of safety behaviors. And so as animals, we see that we are really quite, you know, like, urgently trying to steer the ship towards well-being, towards safety. And, you know, the Buddha emphasized vedana, you know, the kind of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and pleasant sort of signaling a kind of security, safety, well-being, unpleasant signaling threat. And our emotional life is a kind of elaborate way of managing the threats and opportunities of being human. Our thinking life, you know, the kind of compulsion to stay oriented, to have a past and a future, to be here and not there, to know who I am, to know where pain is, to know where pleasure might be. To know all of this is like a way of trying to establish our own safety, yeah? And sometimes as we start to get quiet when we sit, it's like we some of the conversation about our experience, some of the story of self, of world, it starts to get quiet. But as we get more quiet, sometimes it can be this kind of sense of defenselessness, that was actually the kind of compulsive narration of the moment was keeping me safe. And if I just get still, if I let the silence start to colonize body and mind, I'm exposed. So we're trying to navigate this, and we do this in a lot of ways. Dharma practice is both a recognition of the depth of these habits, the kind of the poignancy of that longing to be safe, to be well, and also is a way of actually establishing more and more safety, well-being, stability. So we begin with the precepts, you know, and yeah, I've always been very touched by a line that a monk uttered, you know, after whatever, like 30 or 40 years of monastic practice, and just described his aspiration as to be safe for all beings. And that is a very beautiful aspiration, and one that takes a whole life to bring to fruition, to truly be safe for other beings, because that means that we actually have to work through any of the seeds of suffering that might be a cause to harm another, that might be a cause for defensiveness or resentment or greed. Yeah. And this comes out of a phrase from the suttas, to make oneself a refuge for all beings. Yeah. And so in some ways our ethical life is the beginning and the fruition of the path. When we agree not to harm each other, that is not like an incidental piece of what we do. That's not like, oh yeah, we do the refuge and precepts because that's what we've done, you know. It's like, no, actually we're creating a field of safety where we can actually start to let go of some of the vigilance and some of the need to be tracking threat. I teach teen retreats. Once a year I teach a teen retreat, and it's like 45 kids, 15 to 19 year old, doing a retreat, and it's not all silent. We don't get up at 5:30, but they're like really doing it. They're like moving in and out of silence with chunks, significant chunks of silent practice, and then kind of, you know, group work, and then it's a little like camp, and it's all kind of blended together. With that setting, it's like, yeah, the precepts, letting go of sexuality, drugs, and alcohol, that's like an urgent concern of the teachers, you know. There's one year where they just held it so beautifully, you know. It was just like so pristine, not just around being careful with sexual energy or abstaining from drugs or alcohol, but just like a kind of authentic kindness just rippling through the whole retreat. Yeah. And it had this effect of creating this like really like just beautiful field where different things were possible, a kind of field of well-being. And on the last night of the retreat, which was New Year's Eve, we have a dance party, you know, and it's like bring in the new year, then dance a little bit, and then the plan is to usually go to sleep. Yeah. So at this dance party, which went till 5:30 in the morning, because it was just like so beautiful watching what they created. Yeah. But I had this moment that like left a very deep mark on me. A couple of the kids, as it happens, many years, a couple of the kids confided to this adult staff that they'd experienced childhood sexual abuse. And you know, we have to deal with that and meet that challenge in ways. But I remember looking out at the dance floor, and those two kids, like, were just dancing with their peers. And like very evidently, like just free and safe in their bodies, you know, and just actually able to be a kid, you know. And totally dependent on the kind of exquisite way that the container was held, yeah, the field that was created. And it was yeah, amongst the most kind of beautiful moments of my life, just to see what's possible when a kind of commitment to non-harming is palpable. And so our ethical goodness becomes a kind of a force of well-being. One teacher said, the Buddha talked about that, like that phrase, the bliss of blamelessness. And Ajahn Amaro, a monk in the Thai forest tradition, said, here's the most basic form of therapy. If you don't do things that you don't regret, you won't regret them. Yeah. And it's kind of like, okay, yeah, right? But, our sort of the sense of actually like refuge in goodness, refuge in like ethical wholesomeness, it, like tremendous source of well-being, of fearlessness even. And so as we become more and more deeply aligned ethically, as we like are in alignment with our own deepest values, there is this sense of being more and more transparent. There's less and less to hide. There are fewer and fewer secrets. Because to stay hidden is painful. It takes work. there's this this researcher who is known really for doing thought suppression research. So looking at the kind of the mechanisms and consequences of suppressing thoughts, you know. And he writes, keeping our thoughts to ourselves is not easy. Secrecy is an active process, as it requires much deliberate behavioral and mental work. At times, it seems that the more we try to hide something, the more likely we are to reveal that very thing. The cognitive maneuvers necessary for keeping a secret create an intentional suppression of the secret thought, the consequence of which is a preoccupation with the secret itself. So, one of the sources of well-being in Dharma practice is we become more and more transparent to ourselves, and we become more and more aligned with our behavior. Our behavior starts to converge with our deepest intentions for how we want to live. This human realm, like what's sometimes called samsara, one way it sometimes gets characterized is as a kind of bombardment that the senses are always being impinged upon. And we can't stop experience from flowing into awareness. And this kind of like the intensity of that, Suzuki Roshi said, you cannot stop your life, you know. You are always changing into something else, always, incessantly. Now there's a liberating side to the relentlessness of change, to the relentlessness of experience. And there's a fatiguing side of it too, you know. And so sometimes it does feel like we're kind of bombarded and we want shelter from the storm, shelter from the kind of storm of changingness. And of course, in an important sense, there is no shelter from changingness, but the closest shelter that we get maybe is samadhi, is the gathering of the mind. So that word is translated as concentration, but more like suppleness and unification of the mind. And as the mind settles and gathers, we stop being just bounced around by the kind of pinball machine of our thoughts. So much, you know, of just kind of lurching forward and back. And our thoughts start to lose some of their kind of gravitational pull, you know. You know that sense of like just the kind of gravitational pull of thinking? And that's because our thoughts, when we're thinking them, they all feel totally inspired. You know, they feel urgent. Yeah, the Nobel laureate Kahneman said, "Nothing in life is as important as you think it is, while you are thinking about it." Yeah, while we're thinking about it, that's all that matters. That's all that exists sometimes. Yeah. And this kind of quieting and gathering of the attention, it just like things just start to settle, a very kind of healing quality to that. There are many flavors of concentration, of samadhi. Sometimes just, that kind of sukha, sort of like quiet pleasantness, and sometimes much more intense kind of rapturous feeling. This is from the Anguttara. From this sutta, just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from the east, west, north, or south, so that the cool fountain of water welling up from within would permeate and pervade, suffuse and fill the lake with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. So too the monastic permeates this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. There is nothing of their entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of concentration. We can move in progressive ways through deep states of unification, where the mind is gathered, and the objects of focus become progressively more and more refined. The body kind of no longer seemingly there, the mind just barely there, and something like the boundlessness of space, all that's left of our being. The source of well-being, and it's the fruit of letting go of the need, the wish to even be concentrated. Yeah, not something that's engineered, but actually supported by by relinquishment, letting go. Loving kindness, metta, is it's sometimes said to be like the glue of the universe, that it holds together relationships and families and communities. Whereas as greed and aversion, delusion, they are forces of separation, of breaking things apart. It's love that holds things together. Nayana Punikatera says, love without desire to possess, knowing well that in the ultimate sense there is no possession and no possessor. Love without selecting and excluding, knowing well that to do so means to create love's own contrast, dislike, aversion, hatred. Love embracing all beings, small and great, far and near, be it on earth, in the water, in the air. Love that is strength and gives strength. This is the highest love. There's a kind of steadiness that comes with love. The mind broadens and expands. Suffering so often collapses the attention. We get kind of the attentional scope narrows, and love kind of, it just expands the whole field. It's such a relief, actually, to care about something other than oneself. And the Buddha has kind of other words about what we long for most, as beautiful as love is. There was some years ago, I went to a day long retreat on love, and maybe it was 100 people or something like that, and it was all about love. It was beautiful. And at some point they had us line up, like 50 people here, 50 people here, and we were looking at each other from a few feet away, and one at a time, each person would be blindfolded and peel off the end of the line and walk down the kind of like tunnel of kindness, as it was called, something like that. And each person, all 100 people, would like grab the shoulder of the person walking down the tunnel and whisper sweet wishes in their ear. Yeah. And I remember, like, you know, some people would say something like very generic, you know, just like, may you be happy or something. And so very sweet, but just non-specific. And then sometimes, like, I wasn't teaching. I was sitting that day. I was quiet. I think I had asked maybe one question or something. But, like, a bunch of people had, like, deep insight into my neurosis and and like what I needed in life, you know, and they said it, you know, and so there I am, like, just totally suffused with this, and then, you know, I'm whispering to people and I'm like trying to pick up on the vibes of people and where they are and what they need. And this one woman who was sitting right in front of me, like, I could tell she was really taking in the teachings, and it was just like, I could just feel the sincerity. And when she came down the tunnel, I like whispered into her ear, like, I think you're falling in love with the Dharma. And she, like, squealed with delight, you know, this is going on for, like, an hour and a half or something, you know. It was just, like, totally drenched in love, yeah. And as, like, beautiful as that is, you know, there's only one state that doesn't fatigue the heart whatsoever. Peace. It can never be out of balance. So this is what the Buddha calls the highest happiness. For the heart to be actually responsive to the world, but undisturbed and undisturbable. So we develop this kind of foundation of well-being. It happens in many ways. It happens without us even seeing it, maybe. It happens even when we're suffering. And over time, there's a kind of... our life starts to feel like enough. And there's a kind of courage that opens up to know even more, to be entrusted with more truth. It's like the ground is fertile and open and can actually receive that in a way that where the first noble truth, that there is suffering, is not actually a cause for despair, but actually an uplifting confirmation. So Rumi says, if you bake bread with the wheat that grows on my grave, you'll become drunk with joy, and even the oven will recite ecstatic poems. If you come to pay your respects, even my gravestone will invite you to dance. So don't come without your drum. Sit for a moment. Those words are offered for your consideration. And please pick up whatever supports your well-being, your ongoing unfolding, and leave all of the rest behind.